The hills are alive with the sound of queer Indians. Hey guys, it's Maya, back with a new episode of the Gaijin Podcast. Thankfully, I'm not recording this intro from a porta potty on a Torrey Pines fairway. Back at home with Cora munching on a bone in the corner and staring at me weirdly. Anyways, this past week has been really cool because it's been full of conversations about the new Sonam Kapoor Bollywood movie that features a queer love story. Like, an actual queer love story. Like, not one that is vaguely referred to or one where I'm yelling in the back of the room, Kiran Parminder are girlfriends, okay? But an actual real one. Yeah, I know. Insert a ton of exclamation points and an image of me crying, watching queerness be a part of Bollywood, like a huge part of our culture. Yes, Bollywood is Indian culture. Leave me alone. I love it. Slide into my DMs. Let's talk about Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham. Anyways, Ek Ladki Ko Dekha To Aisa Laga is certainly a step forward in representation, though it isn't perfect. But we at the Gaijin Podcast and Project wanted to continue talking about queer Indian representation, the undeniable importance of it, and what that looks like when told through different lenses. So, this week, we're doing just that. I am so excited about this episode, and it's with filmmaker Kesav Wable and his brother Samarjeet. They're talking about a new short film that they made called Closet Soups, which is an exploration of queer Desi identity, first-generation Desi American experience, reconnecting with our elders, and superheroes. So you know it's extremely my shit. It is a true love letter to identity and to Kesav's brother's queerness and their relationship. And it's just really, really, really wonderful. And I'm so excited to have more people lay their eyes on it and be as excited about it as I am. A quick note, in a portion of this episode, we talk about bigotry. Trying to get our heads around biphobia, trying to understand why folks in the queer community are bigoted against fellow queer folks. In an effort to explore that and the idea that this hatred sometimes comes from fear of the unknown, though by no means that does not excuse biphobia or any bigotry, I very ineloquently tried to talk about the implicit biases and judgments that I am trying to work through. It was an effort to talk about how we aren't perfect and that there are shitty thoughts that pop up, and that's okay, but it's so important to acknowledge them so that we can work through them instead of ignoring them and letting them simmer to the point where these bad thoughts are acted upon. For me, I've had some very shitty biases and judgments that tread into transphobic thoughts, and I am really ashamed of having them. But I really want to, and I'm currently working on working through those, as they are definitely a function of my lack of understanding of the trans, gender nonconforming, and genderqueer experiences. In this section, I didn't appropriately express my thoughts as well as I wanted to, and I really want to apologize to anyone who may feel invalidated. I see you, I respect you, your experiences are just as valid as anybody else's, and I am so sorry for the indelicacy of my word soup brain. I really hope that you enjoy this conversation with Kesav and Samarjeet. It's really, really fun, and it gets into a lot of really cool things about Desi identity, Indians in outer space, queerness, Amar Chitra Katha comics, and whether or not conference calls are basically chat roulette. So, without further ado, this is the Gaijin Podcast with Kesav and Samarjeet.
Thank you.
Okay, so the last podcast episode I did, I tried to do this like very like mysterious way of introducing my guests without saying their names. That just was the dumbest thing in the world. It's like, Maya, don't try to be funny. You're not. So
with the right sound design, it could work though.
I'm like never going to do it again. I hire somebody to do sound design. So instead of embarrassing myself, today I have two guests, which is like new and fancy. It's like uncharted territory for the Gaijin podcast, especially doing it remotely. But can the both of you introduce yourselves?
Let's go. I'll go first. All right. So I'm Kaysav Wable. I'm a creative slash lawyer in New York, mostly in filmmaking and theater. And yeah, I've been here for 15 years, and that's kind of my basic, in a nutshell, intro. And I'm South Asian, specifically from Bangalore, India.
All right. I'm Samarjeet Wable. I'm, let's see, I guess a cisgendered male, kind of exploring his queer identity fully, I guess, or kind of going back and forth about that since high school. We can probably get into that. And let's see, I'm in Boston right now, but I was in Philly for like 10 years before that and grew up in Jersey, like a New Jersey suburbanite. So I've just lived primarily in the Northeast coast of the US.
So, yeah. So like full opposite of me.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I hope you understand. Yeah. I was talking to another, South Asian person in Philly. And they were telling, I was like, yeah, I've like never really been to an actual temple that wasn't in a strip mall. Like that just wasn't like an office building essentially, but like turned into a temple. They were like, come to New Jersey, and just like went on this whole thing about like South Asian culture in New Jersey. And I was like, what is this whole new world that like I have never experienced before?
We try to keep it real here.
Yeah, it's like fully Little India in New Jersey. Okay, so I met Kaysav. Well, you slid into my DMs, which was like very flattering.
I did.
But gross. I got like so gross. But yeah, you were like, hey, like I have this really cool short film that I did that is about like queerness in Asian identity. And like right off the bat, I was like, okay, this sounds dope. You know, like anything that's like exploring the intersection of those ideas is always, you know, something that I'm searching for, especially like in the film medium. So I was super excited to talk, you know, like to hear about that, hear more about the film. And then when you were like, hello, I'm South Asian, and you're like, I'm Desi. Like a lot of the stuff that my film is talking about is that intersection, not just with like Indian culture, but also Hinduism. I was like, what the fuck? Like, this is what I think about all the time. And so it was like really, really exciting to connect with you because I don't know. I don't really know that many other people that are actually looking at that intersection of queerness and Hinduism, which is really interesting to me. So I don't know if like the two of you wanted to talk, maybe I feel like talk more about the film, like intro the film. So like,
yeah, totally. Yeah. That would be good.
So, really cool.
So this is a film. It's loosely based on our lives. It's about two stepbrothers who host a podcast. So we're getting meta here. It's a film about a podcast where one stepbrother is straight and the other is queer. And they talk about queer culture and identity in comic books. So they kind of break down and nerd out over comic books on these podcasts. And the episode that they're shooting when the film starts, or recording rather, is the episode about the Amar Chitrakatha comics from India, and specifically the one that talks about the Mahabharata, and it's an episode of the Mahabharata. And in this specific episode, the hero Arjun has a exile that he has to live in an assumed identity as a femme eunuch. after losing like a battle. So it's sort of taking that as a jumping off point, and a listener of one of the podcasts comes in and confronts one of the brothers later in the film, and that takes them on this unexpected journey. And that kind of ties back into my personal journey, meeting my estranged father's side of the family, and discovering later on that they were a Trump voter. So that's kind of like where it...
I'm so excited to talk about that. So I watched the short again this afternoon. So I was like, it was fresh in my mind. And it's like, there's so much there. It's really, really like a great, like, kind of introduction to this, discussion about like queerness in South Asian families. And I know, like, I was talking to you when we did like our really long phone call where we nerded out over the Amarachandra Katha books,
right.
which I also grew up on. So like, I love that. But you talked about how the sense that I got from you about this film is that it was like such a love letter to your brother, and like kind of this like, you know, exploration of your, you know, interactions with queerness before somebody that you were really close to came, you know, like started considering his own queerness.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, like, you know, like for me, when you were talking about that, I was like, wow, this guy is like such a great ally. You're just like, it was like really, really refreshing to hear like a brown boy talk about, you know, talk so thoughtfully about, you know, queerness and give a lot of acknowledgement to your own kind of struggles, like, and, you know, with homophobic thoughts and things like that I know a lot of us have had, while not taking space away from your brother's experience and using that as a way to uplift it. And I mean,
yeah,
it's really cool. And I was wondering, like, what like this whole like the journey to like creating this final like short film was like, and like the whole process of telling that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I, you know, I'll take some kind of like I would say a little bit of pause, just because I asked some if you wanted to actually be in the film initially. Some is short for Summerjit, so that's our nickname for him. But anyway, so I asked him to be in the film, but our schedules were not, you know, lining up, and I had to go pretty fast because I was shooting this to get it into the HBO Asian American Visionaries competition that is in deliberations right now. So I needed to kind of get a move on it, but I told him, you know, I kind of in advance, like, hey, listen, like, I'm kind of, you know, unpacking our relationship in this short film. So I'm going to cast somebody, you know, that to play, you know, a facsimile of you. And, you know, obviously, and again, like, I think I used our relationship and fictionalized what the details of it were, because I wanted to, more than talking about just, you know, kind of queer identity and how it fits into our kind of Asian upbringing, I wanted to also just talk about, you know, the possibility of healing a relationship, and the possibility of like growing closer because of this identity being, you know, in question or in play, you know. So it was less about kind of stamping one person or another and saying that they have to live up to this or that, you know, lifestyle, but or just to say, you know, we could all look back and be more compassionate towards one another, type of thing. So when I started doing it, you know, the process happened so fast that I really have to like kind of look to my actors were really brilliant in kind of understanding that I was directing from like a personal perspective and trying to nail the dynamic that Summerjit and I, like, and I have, but dramatize it and kind of lift it up, elevate it in like a fun way, and tie it into that comic type of feel.
What about you? It's so weird how this thing like changes. Sorry. When somebody is talking, it's like weirding me out a little bit.
It's like online poker almost.
Do you guys remember Chat Roulette? I'm so sorry to reference Chat Roulette in this because it's like not really. That was where Evil lived. It kind of reminds me of Chat Roulette. Anyways, so sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. It's been a while since I Chat Roulette, to be honest. I don't even remember what that looks like.
Oh, you used to use it? Jesus.
Yeah, yeah. You sound like you were a regular on Chat Roulette. Yeah. I heard things about this.
Like, I was real my password for it. Like, No, I guess I could say when Kesav told me about this, and especially when he like finally presented the short like to kind of like our family, and he kind of introduced it. Kesav, let me know if I misremember anything, but you're talking about like how like, oh yeah, you know, I just, you know, was dealing with a strained relationship, and like that I kind of like maybe had to deal with some things on my own and blah blah blah, and like how that affect the relationship. And like as he was saying it, like in my head I was like, that's not what happened, like because when I guess, sorry, I might kind of bounce around a little bit. When Kesav asked if I wanted to do this podcast recording, because he was like, you know, I'm gonna talk about this film and like, you know, our relationship is, you know, a basis for part of it, etc. I told him, I was like, actually, even though I've been out before and I came out to my brother and stepbrother, we have a middle biological brother, or my biological brother, his stepbrother. I have since kind of like re-closeted almost, I guess. I'm kind of in a weird spot for myself. I can go into that. So I was like, I'm not sure. But the thing, I don't know, Kesav and I, we haven't talked about this, but like, mm-hmm. The thing is, when I got that text about it, I got this like anxious pit in my stomach, but the anxious, it wasn't like, oh, you know, whether or not to, like to do it. The anxiety was like, oh, it is the right thing to discuss this, to be more open. Because like any of my fears or insecurities about, you know, that, about being like kind of figuring out if I'm bi or like what's the right label for myself, etc. It wasn't like, oh, is that a right thing to do to express myself as that or not? It's more like, oh, the reactions I've gotten from other people historically, like that's the thing I was fearful of.
Yeah.
I was fearful of like things that I knew that were wrong. So like, oh yeah, no, if they react in a weird way or in a way that like hurts or offends me,
yeah.
So like that's the thing I guess I was maybe a little apprehensive about or whatever.
Yeah.
So in terms of the film, when he was saying like, yeah, you know, I had like this weird perspective where it's different, like almost like offensive perspective, I was like, no, like not at all. That's not what, like when I finally kind of decided, sorry, I'm kind of a little over, I'm a little nervous.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's just a safe space.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Mike. So I guess I kind of first, like in terms of like finding my identity or kind of getting into it, I was almost like weirdly always attracted to women, like even since I was like 4. Like I just had like an idea of like, you know, kind of like hyper about it. And then around 5th grade, I suddenly became attracted to like a really close male friend of mine. And I just had not, I mean, you know, 5th grade, like what, like 10, 11 years old. Like I had not been versed in much like queer culture. So I was like, what? Like how is this possible? This, you know, and then over time, like into high school, like, you know, middle school, high school, I realized like, oh, I'm attracted to men and women. And once I was telling Kesav before, like, once I realized that and I had like an identity of it, like, and I knew what bisexual meant or like what I thought it meant, etc. I was literally proud. Like I was calling friends to be like the most out person ever. And like, yeah, cool, great. Like, it's like, obviously who cares, but like, but it took me a while to talk to my brother and stepbrother about it or any family member. And I remember I was like, okay, I'm coming home for like, I think it was like a Thanksgiving or Christmas, like one of the holidays we were home in Pennsylvania. And I was like, okay, I'm doing this. And I told Abhijit, our middle brother, I guess, first. And again, in case if you don't know this, or maybe we have talked this before. So I told him first. And his first reaction, his first like absolute reaction was like, huh, okay, so you like both. I'm like, yeah. And then the second thing was like, so like, you probably told Queso first, right? And I was like, no. Also, this isn't about you. Why? But no, it was very kind of like a sweet, petty concern. And then I tell Queso, and Abhijit's there for it as well. And they go over it and, you know, talk it through. Again, Queso, my memory is like, you're both very extremely supportive. And then the funny second beat was, I was like about to be like, okay, so like, you know, I'm going to tell like dad and my stepmom and, you know, Queso's mom. And they both like just completely in sync were like, no, absolutely not. And I was like, what? What? Like, what? Why? What do you mean? What's like, I'm so offended. And Maya, I've heard like one or two of your podcasts, where I don't know if is cursing okay, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We do so much, and it's usually me, so you're totally fine.
Okay, so yeah, I asked why, you know, very self-righteously, etc. And Queso immediately was like, he's like, well, like, I don't tell my parents like who I'm fucking. I'm like, yeah, okay, I guess.
Oh my god. The idea of like talking to Indian parents about like
About anything.
No. Oh my god, that gives me like, I don't know. I was thinking about it the other day, and I was like, it's.
I honestly, forgot I said that. Sorry.
Like literally, not even about like what gender of the person that I'm right. with is. It's literally the fact that I'm dating another. Like the idea of like being with another person. That's no. That gives me like so much anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and then the thing is, like, you know, and maybe that's something subconsciously that was, like, stuck in my head as one of my reactions that I might, like, now, like, looking back, I may have revised, like, or, like, you know, qualified, yeah. And said, like, well, wait for the right time, you know what I mean? Like, but, yeah, so, like, when I was thinking about this, like, movie, right, kind of just to jump off of that idea, is that after, you know, Samarjit, when you like came out to us that Thanksgiving, for me, I remember getting a kind of pit of anxiety in my belly at that point, because I thought, like, in my mind, I thought about all the times before that I'd like, you know, like called him gay or called, you know, said a homophobic joke, like those like little moments that probably in Samarjit's mind didn't even register that heavy, but like, you know, like the like kind of immediate like not self-knowledge, like, you know, that kind of behavior might have adversely impacted him, you know, or impacted anyone you care about. Because I had another friend come out to me at the end of high school, come out to a few of all of his friends, and it was that kind of like, you know, damn, like I made fun for that, and that, you know, that's like a shitty feeling, you know. And in a way that's like makes you want to kind of be better about it. And I thought that was something that might resonate in terms of just like with anybody that has, you know, has to kind of accept people in their life for whoever they are, because it's like that's what you do if you love somebody, you know, that's what you do for family or you know, people you consider close. And I think that ideas is kind of what I was working from and towards, and trying to like bring in the Amar Chitrakatha like comic and talk about, you know, the Mahabharata and that moment when Krishna reveals himself to Arjuna and you know, talking about dharma and like basically talking about the meaning of life, really. Like he's kind of giving a little kernel of like what the meaning of life is. And
sorry.
Oh no, it's okay. I have a dog too. He's snoring over here.
I think somebody like walked by the door and she got so, really accentuating the story of Krishna.
Yeah. But yeah, so I forgot like what the train of thought was. But I guess what I was getting at is that, you know, because the Mahabharata is also about that dynamic of recognizing a rift in your family and still kind of following what your, you know, kind of truth is, and like, you know?
Cora, come here. You're too much. Hey, Come here. Sit.
Your dog looks like my dog.
She does.
I have a dog too. Yeah.
Hey.
I'm sorry.
No, okay. I really love that, because every time that I've thought about like queerness, in, you know, like just trying to like understand it in like the context of being Indian and like not wanting to feel like my queerness, you know, prevented me from still being really in touch with like the culture and Hinduism and things like that. I've always tried to ground it in, like, the Ramayana was, like, my thing, out of the two epics, that was, like, my jam, but I always try to, like, ground it in the epics, and try to, like, pull those stories out of it. So when, you know, like, you talking about, you know, starting this short, like, from looking at the Mahabharata, was really cool, like, that really resonated with me, and it was such a great way to think about it and contextualize it within Indian culture, because I think so often when we're thinking about, you know, what is the state of the queer community in India, most of the times we're like, oh, it's a third world country, so everybody is like, you know, like it's very anti-gay, which I think to a certain degree it is, but so many of those attitudes are derived from like the Brits and like the impact of colonialism. And so I think it's so valuable, and it has been personally really empowering to like go back to like India pre-Britain and see like what that culture is like, and ground myself in that instead of like, you know, having my kind of like conception of what Indian attitudes are like defined by leftover British kind of like laws or attitudes or things like that. So and also, like, Krishna is the gayest god. Like, very gay. I'm not sure how many people are listen to this are well versed in like Hinduism, but like Krishna is always fucking with women who are like washing their clothes by a river. is always like eating ghee. Is very, very flamboyant, but like assured of, you know, like very like self-assured in his like identity. So it's like,
well,
this
actually reminds me, like, Samarjit was just, we just like had a like, just, you know, checked in right before jumping on to, you know, to talk about like, you know, different things we might want to touch on. And Samarjit actually mentioned he went to see Bohemian Rhapsody. Recently, so you can explain it some, but just like that idea of like queer, like a kind of self-possessed queer male, you know, identity that Krishna had, that I think like you were talking about, Summer, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, like it was funny because like I just kind of on my own, I like to write some songs and perform them when I can, or perform with, you know, a few people. And
wait, I love that. I want to talk more about that after you finish this. But that's amazing.
He's a good songwriter.
Yeah, anyway, we'll see. But like, so when kind of growing up, especially like growing up in, I don't know, like, I guess any part of Western culture, but like specifically like, you know, New Jersey suburbs, being exposed to any kind of like general pop culture, pop media, you don't really see a lot of like, you know, Indian, like South Asian, you know, frontmen of like bands and everything. And I was kind of, I mean, I don't think it was a conscious thought or like, you know, process, but I just kind of accepted like, oh yeah, you know, that's probably not going to be me. You know, that's probably not going to be happening. And then like watching Bohemian Rhapsody, is like, oh yeah, duh. Like the most famous like frontman of all time, of the best band in the world, like was in this sense. It's like, yeah, that happened. And then also on top of that, Rami Malek, I believe that's the actor's name. Like,
yeah.
I mean, he like really got the performance so well, but even if it was kind of exaggerated or, you know, kind of taken from what he saw or what he could see, it was just a really, to me, I got the experience of this like kind of pure masculine queer energy, which is a very specific type of energy, I think. And it's just like, oh yeah, I haven't been around that in a while. Like maybe, you know, either maybe kind of intentionally or not, I guess, but it just kind of like fed me in a certain specific way. And I remember I was telling Kaysov just before, like, I, you know, I saw this with my friend. She's waiting for me in a lobby. I go to the bathroom, just kind of like wash my face. and I look up in the mirror and I'm just looking at my like so I have a mohawk right now, the podcast listeners can't see it, but like and I had kind of gone back and forth with it before, and I was like, you know what, now maybe I should just have like a regular haircut. And I was going back to a regular haircut and just looking myself in the mirror after having this experience of like, oh yeah, you can be of Indian descent and be a musician or a performer and be, you know, and connect with an audience. Like, it's really, really beautiful. I just like look up in the mirror. I'm like, you know, this haircut's just, this doesn't inspire me to write music. This is kind of like, and it's such
sometimes
a,
sometimes you got to start with that.
I mean, yeah, it's such a superficial, dumb little thing, but that was just kind of enough to be like, you know, I'm going to kind of make a little, just at least a physical change and see how it goes.
I love that. I love, like, I mean, like, you know, like thinking of Freddie Mercury as like you were saying, like this, that masculine queer energy. Like, I totally know what you're talking about. And it, at the same time, it's so hard to, you know, like to describe at the same time, right?
Yeah. I was literally walking differently, like outside the theater. That's, I was like, amazing. Oh yeah. Like,
hell yeah. Yeah, but I love, like, thinking of that in, like, the context of Krishna, because, like, totally Krishna would do that shit. Like, he'd be like, hell yeah. Just, like, for fun, Krishna would be like, you know what? Maybe I will be the front man of, like, this huge ass.
Super band.
I do see that. I fully see that.
I mean, and I think a lot of the best front men, like Prince, I mean, you know. Yeah. Little Richard, they all have that kind of, that energy that's like, that's both androgynous, like both at once type of thing. And really, yeah, like indescribable. And it's, and so we have that, we kind of own that as a culture. Like, and I think one of the things, dangerous things that's happens in our culture, and I'm including media in this. I'm including, you know, music in this, and like pretty much anything that's mass consumed, is that the talk of sexuality, you know, queer identity, gets kind of assumed to be like a fringe issue or like a non-mainstream issue, and because of that, what happens is the dominant narrative gets to take over and monopolize, you know, religion and monopolize those spaces that really have a lot of people's ears, you know, and by kind of being silent about, you know, your interpretation of the religion or your interpretation of this story to your life and the relevance it has to your life, you kind of concede that ground and that turf. And it's like, that's one less space that you can kind of, you know, hash out these identities and issues and on a more like, you know, so like sober intellectual level, and not make it about you are a blasphemer, you're like, you know, you don't fit in, and like make it about more about, okay, we have space for this in our culture. Like, there's a reason why these things were written into an ancient, you know, way of thought, basically.
Yeah, the dominant thought nowadays is that like queerness is a Western idea, but it's like, no, actually, if you go back and look at, you know, native cultures, like all ancient cultures have had, you know, like ideas or stories of, you know, gender fluidity, and some form of queerness, in one way or another. And like, I always like to joke about, you know, like Indian culture being so repressed now, because like in a lot of ways it really is, even though like we have the fucking Kama Sutra, like, you know, like it's a culture that is so dominated by, you know, like this flamboyant you know, like ownership of sexuality, of, you know, like, you know, gender fluidity and all of these different things that like gets lost, like you're saying, you know, in this narrative of, you know, these issues being fringe issues. I'm curious, okay, so we talked a little bit about Amartya Katha, but I'm so curious about like what the impact that had on both of you, like, you know, growing up, because literally those comic books were how I learned anything about India and anything about Hinduism. And I like treasured those so much. And I like, when you talked about it on our phone call, I was like, wait, I literally thought I was the only person that was so obsessed with these things and like got all my knowledge from them. But they like, they fully impacted the way that like I interacted with the culture, and it made me like really, really excited about being Indian and like very, very proud of it. Started my obsession with like comics in general, which is always a fun thing. But yeah, it had, I think because I was interacting with Hinduism and all of these stories through that particular format, as opposed to hearing it being passed down by elders or in the voice of somebody else, I was able to have more of an ownership over it. And as I was growing older, was able to kind of like, you know, insert myself into it and insert my own voice and my experiences onto these stories, as opposed to continually hearing them from like another person's voice, which has definitely been really influential on me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I had a little bit of both, I have to say. Like I was, you know, raised in India for a good chunk of my life before I was 10. So when I would go there, I mean, my grandma, that was like one of the things that she did, she would do. She would sit me down and we would like, I would go to sleep while she would tell me stories about Ramayana and Mahabharata and stuff. And obviously during the time that I was in India, also this famous TV show took over the whole country, the Mahabharata, that was like a television series.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like the original, like, you know, binge watch type of thing for Indians, like people would shut down. The streets would shut down, like people would be watching this, you know, around the TV. So, you know, so I related to, you know, had points of entry from it and from different angles. And also I learned vocal Carnatic music too. So, you know, I was steeped in it, in the lyrics of those, the devotional songs to the stories that get repeated there. But the Amar Chitra Katha was like, what, like one of the most fun, like you said, it was like, it reminds me of just like, you know, summers, just like sitting on the garden like stoop or whatever, and like flipping through those pages and reading the little, you know, silly stories, because a lot of times like they take very complex stories that are actually like, you know, hundreds of pages long, and they distill it to like a very simplistic like 15 pages. But it was fun, you know, and it kind of visually, like, it was fun to see these things come to life, right? These moments.
But
some, I don't know, did you even read those? Like, did you ever read Amar Chitra Katha?
No, not at all. No.
Oh my God, that's
no,
can we retape that? Because this is for the film, all right? So we have to actually, no, I'm just kidding.
No, it's funny, like,
loyalists only.
I like knew of them, like I could visually even see them, but I never checked them out, because I guess my experience was just like Hinduism growing up was raised by my mom primarily, after our dad and my mom got divorced, and you know, just do prayers every Saturday, go to every kind of function, every like temple function, and obviously growing up in suburban New Jersey, there were actual temples available, so we got to
bragging.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I like my external temples, leave me alone.
But if anything, it was kind of a more of a social cultural aspect to me than anything else. Like, I mean, I guess just like just how anyone can interact with religion in that way, where it was more it was less kind of a spiritual experience, other than like the kind of the collective, like singing the songs and everything together, like knowing how to do that with everyone around me and getting that kind of experience and knowing it's important and hearing like some things of the stories. But if anything, it really was just kind of a like another form of high school cliques. Like it was just like, okay, yeah. even at those like prayer things, it was just like, oh, there's a group of popular teenagers within that subgroup. And then like our like my brother Abhijit and I just kind of being like off on our own, like, all right, cool, I guess we're the, even in here we're like, we're the losers, like that sucks. And I, you know, and okay, so I definitely told you this, when I was like 13 or 14, to my mom, my very again, very self-righteously was like, I am an atheist. I am done with religion and stuff. Like, and she obviously was shocked and a little hurt, but also was like looking back on it, it's like, well, it's not, I wasn't exactly the best participant either. I wasn't culturally knowledgeable about it. Not to take too long, sorry, but
you're fine.
In terms of like kind of being exposed to that kind of religion and spiritual experience, my mom passed about like 7 years ago this coming week, and I went to India to spread her ashes. And because like I am very much an Americanized like Indian, my one of her brothers, my uncle, like had to kind of like just take me through the whole process and just kind of guide me as getting shaved and putting in this toga and like, you know, holding my mom's ashes in this container. And, you know, and it was interesting because, one thing I would just want to put on a podcast, just I think it's as like a public service announcement, is at one point, you know, the holy person is like saying something and my uncle is translating. There's like hundreds of people in the same situation, just kind of sitting in this like, mostly like almost like three-walled exposed area next to the ocean doing this. And at some point, holy person says something to my uncle translates. He's like, okay, so now you, for this day of the, you know, like 10, 14 day process, you have to spread or you have to dump out like half of the container, which is, it's not transparent. It's like half the container of ashes. And I was like, okay, I'll just like feel it out, I guess. And like, I don't know, I've only been exposed to ashes in like movies and things like that. So I'm just expecting like dust. So I'm pouring, and then suddenly like a bone falls out.
Oh my God.
Oh my God, what?
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, so many people don't know this, so I just feel like saying it. So like, so it popped out and like, I'm looking and just like everything is in slow motion. And I can see, I'm like, oh, that is like, that looks like a joint, like, a, you know, like a shoulder, like something.
Oh my God.
My mom. And then obviously everything goes in slow motion. And then I don't know why, but I just like kind of looked back, kind of like turned back to the right of me. And up against the wall of like this kind of hollowed out building was like all these different relatives who came out to show support because they knew I was coming there and, you know, for the funeral and everything or the process, including like people that really didn't need to be like cousins-in-laws and stuff like that. And I was just like, oh, okay, you know, I need to kind of pull it together and like finish this thing. So we do that part, and then there's a second part where, or like, you know, obviously there's multiple parts, but one of the parts is like you're putting the ashes on like these 10 ladus, Indian sweets, represent the 10 days of mourning, and then, you know, you walk into the ocean and kind of dump it into the ocean, which, not great, but okay, like that's part of it. And we're in this like kind of long line of like, again, hundreds of people who clearly like came here just to do this thing. And it's kind of a beautiful moment of like, well, you know, this is a part of life and hundreds of people are doing this now. They're going to do it kind of every day for like, you know, the ever. Rest of the distance. And I'm just having this kind of like beautiful, and my uncle is like holding onto me like really tightly so we don't slip on the rocks into the water and like all this stuff. And walking into the ocean to do this. And I'm having this big, beautiful collective experience. And then all of a sudden, like, this bag of garbage hits my leg and there's a like just white garbage bag just like hits my leg, and on top of it, which I don't know how, but it was like stuck on top, was a Lay's potato chip bag, I guess. I was just like, ugh, get your shit together, India, like, god damn it.
That's the title of this episode, get your shit together, India.
But I just, again, this will take 2 seconds, but I just want to say, like, as a kind of positive, so that was like, yeah, what a weird, funny moment. And then at the last day of mourning, you know, have to do the whole kind of like a longer procession or procedure for the whole thing. And at the end of it, you have to throw the container, after you dump out all the ashes within the thing, within the ceremony, throw the container into this river. Again, not great, but okay, like that's part of it. And and like, so, and when you do it, you're supposed to be done with mourning completely through it. And as I'm getting ready to do it, I'm like, okay. And then I like, as I throw it and as it's like arcing into the river, which is, by the way, like hundreds of miles away from like the Indian Ocean from where we were, etc. What do I see floating down the river? But another white garbage bag was like a Lay's potato chip thing, like stuck on top. And I just started laughing. I'm like, that's hilarious. Like, that's just, it was like a beautiful, like, again, that is a part, like, everything is a part of life, death is a part of life, and this is just, like, you know, it means this death and everything and this whole process, it can mean everything, but it also means nothing, and that's okay, just, like, a part of it.
Wow.
That's
wait, unbelievable. I don't know if we can continue the podcast.
I love how you, like, described it as being like a socio, like, cultural experience, because that's how, like, I've always interacted with Hinduism. Like, when somebody is like, oh, like, what religion are you, I always feel weird about saying Hindu, not because I'm embarrassed, but because I've never considered it to be like a religion. I'm like, this is, my mom always says, she's like, it's not a religion, it's a way of life, and I'm like, okay. Preetha,
my mom,
like,
says the same thing.
Yeah, wait, do we have
that's a so
oh my god, Kesav, are you my Lampa's brother?
This podcast has more and more twists, like, it's like a Shyamalan reboot.
No, yeah, she would always say, she'd be like, it's a way of life, and I'm like, no, that's so true, because it's not like, it isn't like this cut and dry religion. Where, like, all of the, like, even if you're not Hindu and living in India, like, your day-to-day life is so influenced by, like, the different, like, festivals or, you know, like, different, I don't know, religious ceremonies. And I, like, it's such a cool, like, that, what you were talking about, like, thinking of it as, like, a socio, like, cultural, ethno-religious type of deal is so cool. And I don't know if I have anything else to add to that other than it being, but it,
I mean, I think,
yeah.
I have nothing else to say. Well, I was just going to say, like, you know, growing up like that, or, and kind of being aware of that, especially as I was getting into college, a friend, especially in early college, I went to BU at first and then ended up at Temple in Philly. But when I was at BU, I had one friend who suggested that I joined, like, the Indian club. And I was like, all right, that sounds like a repeat of high school. I do not want to do that. Like, growing up in, like, suburban New Jersey, like, it very much was, I had, like, one really good male Indian friend, and we called the others who kind of congregated with each other Indianites, I guess. I was like, okay, yeah. Like, they don't have any other friends outside in any social group. They just hang out with each other. All their parents are doctors. They have cars. Like, I'm not them. Like, that's just petty high school, you know, whatever, click behavior and stuff. But then going into college, and this one friend, he really suggested, like, well, then you can kind of use it as, like, a study of it culturally. And, like, maybe you should be exposed to that, and maybe that'll help. And, like, to be honest, it really did, because it for the first time, I played in their talent show and stuff like that. And I was, because I signed up to do that, he linked me up with this Indian musician who played piano mostly, and then this other Indian singer. Like, again, things I have never been exposed to other than, like, the times I've seen some Bollywood films and be like, ugh, not for me, or whatever. So, like, it, like, really kind of expanded my horizons and allowed me to kind of explore my own culture, or, like, what is, like, literally a part of me, kind of more objectively, I guess. Yeah. And I found that more interesting, or that's how I found kind of access to it.
Right.
How is that, like, your experiences with that, and, like, growing in your understanding of, you know, the cultural aspect of it, how has that impacted your, you know, like, your journey to understand your own identity? What, you know, like, being, you know, navigating queerness, and all of that?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say they're too related, because I would say, in terms of, like, studying, like, kind of Indian culture or being exposed to it in any way, it's kind of more, I mean, again, that as well, I've kind of gone back and forth on it. It's like, okay, am I just looking at this objectively like I would any other culture? And I feed off that. That is interesting to me. Just, like, I don't know, I don't really know much about art, but if I go to, like, art galleries and stuff, you get that experience, you get that enjoyment out of it, you know, just through that sense. But then also, especially growing up where I grew up, where a lot of people kind of, like, you know, and it has continued, you know, since then, that, like, oh, I'm not Indian enough, you know.
Like, I feel that, yeah.
Like, many a girlfriend's parents, like, you know, it's just like, and you know what, I'm it took me a bit, but then it's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm indie enough for me. Like, you know, I like I know who I am. I know how I am. Like, yes, maybe I'm not. I don't participate in every part of the culture as much as other people, but that doesn't make me less Indian. That just makes me a different type of Indian, I think. Yes. But in terms of my, I guess, like my queer identity, which I'm still kind of sorting out, it's, and I was like, when I was checking in with Queso before, I was trying to figure out how to say this, but it's like, when I kind of identified myself when I was like a teenager, I was like, oh, I'm bisexual. But it's kind of like, oh, because that's the term that's available that like says you are attracted to both, I guess, or both, you know, cisgenders. And then kind of over time, I found myself being like, am I more attracted to women? I'm not, or not, or is that really me being less attracted to men? Or is it really kind of a insecurity self-defense mechanism? Because I've also, especially when I was really out, what I've kind of experienced from all corners is like from hetero girlfriends and stuff like that. It's like, I remember this one girlfriend, she said to me kind of after the fact, like years after we broke up and everything, she's like, no, it's not a bad thing, you know, that I'm bi. It's not a bad thing. It's just like, you know, like no hetero woman would like want that. I was like, oh cool. Like that's like, you know, and a lot of, I made, especially when I was in Philly for so long, I made a really great group of friends who were they invited me. I didn't know if they knew what my identity or how to identify me, but they were like, oh, we're having this kind of Cheers for Queers happy hour, and I think you'd like it. It's just kind of like people, like all, you know, identifications, and just really talking. It ended up being like me and a bunch of lesbians. Like that was it. Like I was the only guy. And like I was like, okay, fine. And some of my closest friends for like years, and I was living with a girlfriend at the time who I thought they, like I mentioned that pretty often. I was like, oh, I'm not gonna mention her name here, but like, you know, I talked about her in normal conversation, I thought. And then and I still identified myself as bi, you know, at the time and everything. And then one day the friend who invited me like comes into my office because we had worked together, and she's like, I have something to tell you, but I don't know. I was like, what is it, you know? And they're like, so they found out that like the person you're dating is a woman. I was like, they found out? What are you talking about? And like, you know, someone were like kind of upset. I was like, what the hell, I guess. And I know this is kind of a common thing, like, especially with people who are bi, I think, or it feels weird to say like a common complaint, but a common experience that I've heard before from people who are bi is that, yeah, just like not being indie enough is like, oh, I'm not gay enough. Like, God damn it. Like, what's and for like hetero women, like, oh, I'm not straight enough. It's like, cool. Like, just, I don't know where I belong in that sense. And even some of the closest friends I've made, especially as I was getting into my later 20s and letting them know, or like feeling comfortable to say who I am in that sense, or just even just saying like, oh yeah, I am attracted to men, like just even something as simple as that. Just so many, like the majority of my friends have been women since like elementary school. The number of like, you know, really true confessions, especially getting like drunk or something like that, they're like, oh my God, something definitely would have happened to us, but like now that you're bi, or now that you're like, absolutely not. Like, ugh. I'm like, cool. Like, this is really, so that, especially as that happened in like my mid late 20s, I kind of, as I got like new jobs or like moved to a different area and stuff, I just kind of was like, you know, I'm just not going to say anything. I'm not going to actively hide it, but I'm not going to say anything and then see what happens. And I was like, oh yeah, I got less, or I felt less judged about my masculinity, which is already like, I'm a skinny, like kind of short Indian male. Like there's already enough to deal with, like in terms of like masculine identity, especially in media, like, et cetera. And like, yeah, it kind of, again, as I'm saying it right now, it doesn't feel great. It just feels less bad than being like fully out. So, and I know it's kind of maybe hypocritical or ironic while doing this podcast and talking about this, but yeah.
No, but like, so I had like a similar experience. Like when I was coming into my queerness, I was like, oh, like honestly, like my experience definitely mirrored a lot of what you were talking about, where I was like, okay, like I would talk a lot about how like dudes are hot, and like it got to the point where it was like I was very obsessive over, like, this person is hot. Oh my God, look at Leonardo DiCaprio. Not that hot. I could have done better with my choice. And then I slowly started realizing that, like, I was getting, you know, I was attracted to women. And I was like, okay, I'm bi. Like you were saying, like, it was, that was the label that was available. And I was like,
right.
Okay, like, that's the label. I don't know what's happening. And so I kind of went along with that for a while. But then I was like realizing, I was like, no, it's like fluctuating a lot. Like my level of attracted, you know, like to these different genders is very fluid and it's fluctuating right. A lot. And like, does the fact that today I'm more attracted to a man mean that I'm less gay? Or, you know, like if I'm more attracted to women, does that mean I am too gay? And then there's all of that, like that rabbit hole of internalized homophobia where I'm like, no, I can't be the gay one. I can't be the gay one. I now identify as queer because I feel for myself, it gives me a lot of fluidity in my identity, less pressure to be, you know, any one thing. I feel able to navigate that. But I mean, I've talked to so many friends who like on, you know, like the femme identifying side, if you are bi or queer, like you date both genders, and somebody you're going on a date with is, you know, like full lesbian, only dates women. I've heard from friends who have had interactions with some lesbians that are like, no, like you're, they won't date like bi women or, you know, women who date both genders, which is insane. Like,
it's insane.
It's like none of that is going to impact like the layers that are like in that defensiveness, that biphobia, I guess, for lack of a better term. Right. Crazy.
What do you guys think that is? Like, just to like, you know, kind of jump off that, like, do you think that, like, this question is coming from like clearly like a blind spot because I'm like a cis, you know, hetero male, so I
bragging
like so I'm like what does it feel like to live in this world that demands this like binary kind of, you know, structure where it's like gay, straight, you know, those are the boxes, you know, if you're in between then you like you're waffling, figure it out type of like basically kind of very restrictive like thing that's not how the human experience works. It's not how we perceive like any real emotion or anything with that has that like sort of thing that you find. Like I've been watching this Tidying Up with you know that a Netflix show, yeah. Tidying Up with, and she's like, does it bring you, huh? It's a Netflix show. It's this woman, she's Japanese, like she comes in and helps people like clear up the clutter, and the way she kind of coaches people to clear up the clutter is to pick up an object and then ask, does it bring you joy? And if it doesn't bring you joy, you throw it out. But like, I've been thinking about that phrase a lot, does it bring you joy? And it's like, what brings us joy is so like fleeting from moment to moment. And not that love has to be fleeting, but that, you know, it's an emotion and it's by definition something that is in flux. So when we all kind of know that intuitively as humans, but we still demand people to kind of like occupy these two poles, you know, and stay there, you know, what like, and you guys are kind of like trying to navigate between them and say, no, there's this whole other open space between those goalposts that we kind of live in.
I would say like, I think it's just a different form. I mean, actually not even that different of a form of bigotry and like hate, like just because, especially when I was with that group of friends in Philly, and like, yeah, it was primarily women, and then like one was like, oh yeah, and actually she like is bi, like it was just this kind of derisive and like, so like, she's again like, oh, not gay enough. And I was just like, do you not see like what you are doing? Like, we are literally a exclusive club to be a safe space, and you are being the thing that you
right
everyone should like rally against. Like, that's it.
Yeah,
it's always insane to me. Just, yeah, I don't understand why it continues to exist, but it exists, like, you know, in other
places. I feel like it's just like, I feel like it's like human nature to be afraid and defensive towards things that we don't understand. So I think it's just like a form of that, of like people who are already marginalized, you know, being extra defensive because like already things are really hard. And then that just kind of mutating into something that is unfortunately really gross. But right. I don't think that like, I think for the majority of people that feel that way, I don't think that it's necessarily like a malicious thing for most of them, and more so of like, we were all socialized in this like binary place. And so as soon as something different is like, oh yeah, like you don't have to ascribe to any of these things that we were told exist and hold our society up, then it's all of a sudden like, holy no, what? No. And like a freak out, and like, how do we deal with this thing that isn't menacing, but like just because it's disrupting the way our lives are working and our brains are functioning, it's bad. Because like that happens. Like, I've been thinking about the way that I've been interacting with that a lot recently, because, and it's more so in the form of, you know, like interacting with gender nonconforming folks and trans folks. And I've noticed a lot that, like, I've had, like, a lot of very, like, gut reactions to, you know, like, the gender nonconforming, gender queer, and trans communities that are just transphobic. Like, that's what they are. A lot of my like gut reactions or instant reaction to things are transphobic. And I've been trying to figure out like, why is that? Because I don't want to be transphobic at all. Like that is the thing that I would want to be. So like, where are these thoughts coming from? And like, it's definitely, for me at least, it's been like, I don't understand that experience because it isn't my experience and it's so different from my own that it's scary, and that like I have to force my way through that and be like, okay, like yeah, it's a different experience, cool, like that's like, it doesn't make your experience any less valid than mine. It is just another experience of living, but it's
it
hard
also has to like say. Yeah, it also has, like, whenever I think about that, like, of people having kind of, like, a negative reaction to things, to, you know, being exposed to different things or different ways of being, I always wonder, like, yeah, I totally get, like, a fear or kind of uncomfortable reaction. Like, that makes sense to, like, oh, this is different. I wasn't never exposed to this before. I never understand the second part, when the people go from that to, like, actively hating or actively being negative. It's just like, yeah, but that has nothing to do. It literally has nothing to do with you. Why do the extra step of like, ugh, and they're terrible? Like, it doesn't make sense, like, logically.
Yeah, I remember a couple weeks ago when, I mean, like, this whole Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart, yeah. But Chris Rock had a similar kind of, you know, tone deaf like statement about like it being that like too hard to do comedy now because you can't be like politically incorrect kind of thing, but it's like whatever.
But yeah, when the Kevin Hart thing came out and he did the interview on Ellen, he was like, I don't have a homophobic bone in my body, and I'm like, that's the most bullshit thing in the world, because all of us have, you know, like we all have these judgments against people that are not like us, that tread the, you know, like very closely tread into like homophobic thoughts, racist thoughts, transphobic thoughts, like all the time. Like that's just like how it works when we grow up. But I think like you were saying, Sam, like how, what's the jump, the people who make that jump from like, this is a shitty thought, how do I work through it? And instead go like, I'm having this shitty thought, let me act on it and make somebody else miserable. It's wild, because it's like, we all have this. We're all trying to like fit these differences of our world into these certain categories. And like, sometimes it's like a circle into a square box and we're like, I don't know how this works. But for the most of us who are like good, right? Like, it's just like, okay, we'll figure out, like we'll process it and we'll figure out how to make it work. And then you have like, the assholes who go to like Charlottesville and start parading around like it's 1942. And you're like, no, like what made you do that? Like, how are you so threatened by this to do that?
Right. Yeah. It's just like you already won. You're already like the majority. in those structures and those like situations, like you are the one on top. What are you losing? You literally aren't losing anything. But what? Yeah, I don't get it.
Which is really interesting because, like, so bringing it all back to the short film where you were talking earlier about how like there's a part of it where there's an uncle who voted for Trump, right? And so it's always really, really wild to non-Indian people to be like, wait, Indians voted for Trump? Like, how does that work? And there's like the Desi wall of shame of all the Indians that are like in the administration who are just really fucking up for all of us. And I think that's so interesting because I feel it ties into that like self-preservation. Well, the character in your film like talks about it. He's like, I voted for Trump basically as an act of preservation. And I think that's like so interesting because as a group that could not be less, you know, like Norman Rockwell Americana, and it, like a tiny, like we are 1% of the population, I think, you know, to ascribe to these Nazi adjacent, if not fully Nazi ideologies, like, how do we do that? Like, what is this Desi wall of shame like actually doing?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's something that like when I was thinking about the film and bringing this part in, because it was really you know, drawn from the experience of meeting this paternal uncle and going to his home in Florida and what, you know, finding out that he was. And I'll encourage people to watch the short film. It's called Closet Soups, and you'll find out how it comes up, like the Trump conversation, how it comes up and why it kind of gets woven into the story. But he says that he voted for him because of he thinks that that Trump will be good for radical Islam, whatever that meant in his head. And he brings up the Pulse nightclub as like an incident that, you know, that would have gone differently, in his words, if Trump had been president, like he would have responded differently or whatever. And it's his kind of whatever misled idea. And what's interesting about it is the bringing up the Pulse nightclub shooting is like a very specific incident where it, like, talk about it like an intersectionality, you know, event that shows how all these things are interconnected, and a gay nightclub in, you know, Florida is attacked by a man who is mentally unstable and, you know, shooting innocent people. It's purportedly the name of Islam in radical Islam, but the issues were way more complex than that. But the media kind of like distills it to those two points and glosses over the fact that after the event, you know, Muslims and gays marched together in the streets to kind of show solidarity. So that, to me, kind of shows this huge blind spot in our culture. And I think Desis especially, you know, did vote in large numbers for Trump because, you know, especially Hindu Desis, because of the Hindu-Muslim rift in Indian culture and in South Asian culture, really, between India and Pakistan. So that aspect of our identity kind of gets pushed under the rug here in the States, I think. A lot of times, you know, India, like especially Indians here, they're a very upwardly mobile group. And as you said, the Desi wall of shame, like it's like they have that sort of advantage that they can pass if they just are conservative enough and, you know, make enough money, like they can, like, you know, get the same lifestyle as like the white, middle class and upper class, and you know, they could just sit on that, and that, and they're happy and they're content with that. And I think that, you know, observing this as a first generation, you know, in an American here, and kind of not having that same baggage that my parents or my grandparents may have with Pakistan, and, you know, not having lived through that period of history and having that distance from it, to look at it objectively and say, you know what, like, this is a self-destructive way of thinking, and this is a self kind of a sickness in a way of thinking, because you're literally writing your own kind of death sentence by putting people like Trump in power, because you're just next on the list. Like, you may not be the first on the list or the second on the list, but like, they're definitely like, you know, we're part of the agenda of people that they don't want here. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like being so blind to that is really kind of fascinating for me, to, especially when you come here and you're exposed to different cultures, and especially in our community, a lot of our people are physicians and you know, lawyers and bankers and stuff, and you have a better view of the world, but still to have those kind of communal ways of thinking is really kind of striking to me, you know. And I wanted to show that here, but show it in a way that was like still compassionate, because I, you know, learned this at a time when I was meeting my paternal uncle for the first time. So, you know, I wanted to find out about my dad who passed away when I was 2. Like, that was part of my reason for going there, you know, was this origin story type of journey for me, which kind of is why the comic book element is important to the story too, is that, you know, it's about finding your origins. But once you find them, not always being comfortable with them, it's not always going to be this warm, fuzzy feeling. You know, it's going to have some thorns with it, right? And being kind of looking at those thorns in the sunlight too, and kind of acknowledging them, I think was part of why I made this film.
Well, it's such a true, like, you know, conversation that... a truly intersectional conversation about identity, because you do talk about the queerness. You talk it. A lot of times I've talked to, my English is not so good. I have had like a lot of conversations with other Asian Americans talking about like creating our own Asian American culture. And like, what is that? And I'm so interested in it, you know, like in this sense, because what you're talking about, like as being like first generation Indian Americans and like trying to, you know, trace your roots, understand your culture, and also figure out where you fit in the United States. And then at this, you know, current political climate, where like so many people that look like you are upholding this man who hates literally everybody that looks like you and every part of your it's so confusing. And with Closet Soups, like what I really loved about it is that it was really this intersectional kind of like look at culture and like, you know, beginning, it's a beginning of a conversation that's like establishing a very unique Desi American culture, which I feel like, you know, like that takes so many different forms, but I really loved how like, when I finished watching it, I was just like, wait, I like literally, I could watch a series about this, of like these two brothers talking about the, you know, comic books, and also, you know, like using that as a jumping off point to understand like their own culture and like where they come from was like really, really wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I wrote this for the short film festival, but I mean, I've been thinking about it. Right now we're in post-production and, you know, adding some animation and trying to like really visually elevate it. And I totally agree. Like, I've been thinking about it through this process after having wrapped, and it's like, it is the beginning. It's just the beginning of the conversation. And I think that that this lens of comic books is really something that's, it's not only timeless because it's comic books and graphic storytelling has been around since caveman time, but like now especially it's having kind of a kind of re-emergence as a main format of consumption, like because of these superhero movies and series and into the Spider-Verse, which like I felt like elevated it to another level. Like,
God, that movie was so good.
So good. Like,
I truly cannot handle how, like, that was, I was feeling like superhero fatigue, like hardcore.
Yeah.
And like, literally, if you looked at my apartment right now, half of like everything in my, like, I have superhero shit on my walls. So it was like wild for me to start feeling superhero fatigue. And then I saw Spider-Verse and I was like, oh my God, this is like everything that I've always wanted in my entire life. It's
perfect. Yeah, totally. And I saw it and I was like, wait, I have to get my animation game up in my movie because I can't, I got to get it, you know, get a redux on that. But like, it's such a great, you know, format to talk about these things and in abstractions and still kind of like, you know, touch people's, you know, joy buttons in terms of like visually and their inner child and kind of like getting them to disarm. Because I think a lot of the times part of the problem in our current climate too is that it's really hard to get people to disarm and just talk, you know, and drop the act and drop the like, you know, ideologies and like all these isms and like party lines and stuff and just like talk as like, you know, two creatures that are trying to figure this out, right? And I think that that's what's kind of fun about this format and this kind of level of storytelling is that we get to sit down on the carpet and just like have fun with it, you know. Like,
did you ever see the short? It was a Pixar short called Sanjay's Super Team.
Yes. I watched the trailer for it.
It's amazing. So it reminds me a lot of like what you're doing with Closet Soups, because that whole short was about this like Indian kid who like, you know, his family owned a motel out in like Rancho Cucamonga. And he just spent all day like watching cartoons. His dad was like very religious. And like would, you know, do prayers every morning. And so the way that this kid like started to understand his dad and like understand that, you know, the ritual of making the prayers and all of that every morning was by contextualizing it with his ritual of watching Saturday morning like superhero cartoons. So the whole short is about how he like envisions, I think it's Vishnu, I can't remember, that it's three gods, and he envisions them as like this super team, like these superheroes that are like fighting crime. And it is like it's one of my favorite things that I've ever seen.
I have to check that out.
It's really wonderful, but it's totally along the lines of like what you're talking about here and like what you're doing with Closet Soups, where it's like this is a universally kind of like accessible medium. Like, we all understand superheroes, we all understand that, and then placing it in different you know, cultures, kind of like how Crazy Rich Asians, you know, took this universally understood and beloved genre, the rom-com, and just was like, yeah, also Asians have this too, so like,
yeah.
That's like not weird, we all love it, like obviously non-white people would experience this as well. And I think that like instantly, you know, like helped people disarm and like be like, oh, like holy shit, like I've been wanting to see like a, you know, mid-aughts rom-com for ages, right. Now here it is, like thank God.
Yeah. No, totally. I think, and that's why it's an exciting time now to be Asian and making stuff, right? It's like, you know, I think that people are kind of ready for those stories. And I think that we, as you know, have had the time to marinate in this stuff and now like, you know, tell our stories. Because I think part of it for me also as a personally is that, you know, I spend a lot of years writing projects that are, you know, taking from the you know, South Asian experience or from a minority experience, but I try to write outside my own experience. Like, I know people like always go with write what you know as the first kind of, you know, foolproof method, but I always kind of love to just start somewhere wacky and then like work my way back to, you know, work from there and like try to come down to like the earth and make it real. But this is the first time I just like, I was like, you know what? I'm ready to tell this piece of my life. Like I felt like it placed us in this moment in time in a specific way that I felt compelled to bring to the table, you know, and bring to the audience.
I'm really curious about what both of your experience. So, Sam, when you were talking about like the clicky Indians, like, yeah. That is such a specific and like vivid image, and I really appreciate that a lot because I totally know the people you're talking about. But I'm curious about what your guys' experience with you know, like being Asian, because like I know for me, growing up, everybody was like, no, you're not Asian. And I'm like, I'm so sorry, but did you look at a map recently? Like, yes, I am. And so up until basically I started doing the Gaysian Project, and I was like, no, fuck you all. Indians are Asian too. Like, we need to like widen this image of what, you know, Asian is. I never felt like I fit into any Asian spaces. And that has been a really... it's felt like I have been, you know, in this exclusive, this like other branch of an experience, for so long and like isolated in that way, that has been like really confusing. And I was wondering what, you know, I mean, I grew up nowhere near an Indian epicenter, like like the Jersey suburbs. So my experience was definitely like a little bit different. But I was wondering if you guys had any of that same tension, you know, growing up in an Indian suburb or, you know, whatever.
I mean, I can say that, like, yeah, specifically in the New Jersey suburbs, I didn't feel that distinction, primarily because like it was like really Indian. It kind of felt like primarily like half white and half Indian, and then a mix of everything else, I guess. Like, there's a pretty big Filipino population there as well. But then it was kind of mostly when I moved to Philly, and I was there for like 10 years, where I would kind of volunteer for, like you would just say like, you know, an Asian organization, and I'm like, oh, okay, so probably a big mix. I'm like, no, it's primarily like East Asian. And even talking with the people who are like the founders or something after like volunteering and cleaning up, and they're like, even they kind of like laments with like, oh, you know what? Yeah, we used to have like at least part of a kind of South Asian contingent, or like there used to be one other organization that kind of worked with us that was primarily like South Asian, but like, I don't know, they just kind of didn't stick with it, and we were kind of like more mobilized and stuff. So like, yes, my personal experience of it was kind of like, oh, that was kind of sad, where it's not necessarily an active exclusion. It's kind of more of a, like, oh, why aren't enough people kind of stepping up to be a part of an active community, like, within this, an active, like, specifically South Asian American community. And I noticed more recently, along with queer identity and, like, even specifically Asian identities, even though I've been kind of talking about, you know, feeling kind of, like, not enough of everything, I would say just kind of culturally, especially in America, like, there seems to be a lot more acceptance. Like, it's definitely a lot better than it was, like, you know, a couple of years ago, in terms of like finding acceptance from various people. But yeah, I would say like my negative experiences kind of color it for myself, kind of make me fearful and insecure. Whereas like kind of on the outside, things seem to be getting better. And in terms of being Asian, I think I've been hearing kind of more of a more distinction of like, oh, specifically East Asian and South Asian or Southeast Asian. And I think the intention behind that is more of like, no, you shouldn't just think of Asian as one thing. It's all these things. That's why we're saying East Asian, South Asian. Like, it is all part of Asia, but what you're thinking is when you say Asian is like probably wrong, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny, like I was gonna say, I like fired off like an angry tweet like not too long ago because I read NPR, right? Like NPR online, and they had a article about Pakistan and under like it was under the Middle East region, and like that like irked me. I was just like, what? Like this is NPR. Like why is this under the Middle East region? Pakistan is not in the Middle East, you know. It's in South Asia. Like I felt crazy for a second. I'm like, have I all these years like after having written like theses on India and Pakistan and like studying this like inside out, do I just totally not know where it is? And but no, like it's like we might as well be like over there. Like they don't like, I wish that like sometimes they would just drop the act and just be like people from over there, like you know, big blob.
I was just talking to, so like one of the big things that I'm doing with the Gaysian Project right now is a series called Disorient, which is like rooted in disrupting the way that like Asians are viewed in the West, which like totally contributes to that, like, you know, our instant reaction to the word Asian is an Eastern Asian person, like primarily Chinese or Japanese. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, why are our entire lives, you know, like, you know, placed in context of a Western view, like every, you know, like the East is the East in respect to England and the West, right? Like,
right.
And one of the things that's been really interesting is like, if you look at the, I was in a meeting the other day and we're like, okay, so like, what is Asia? So we like literally Googled what is Asia, and it is so like, oh my God, like. Asia goes all the way out to the Middle East, like up to like what the Mediterranean Ocean. And it's really, really interesting because in our, you know, like these, whether they be intentional or not intentional way of like segmenting everybody out, we lose like the common threads of experiences that like all of us from like Asia at large experience. Cause like, I know for me, like, I relate way more to, you know, like Middle Eastern folks and experiences than I would to an Eastern Asian person's experience. Mm-hmm. Like, right. As like brown people, you know, there's so, you know, like, especially our experiences in the United States, it's like very, very interconnected. Mm-hmm. And then like the food and the, you know, like there's so much overlap. And I remember growing up, feeling insane for being like, oh yeah, like I totally relate to this Iranian story, and then being like, wait, no, but I'm Indian, I'm Asian, like right. why can't I do that? And it's so fascinating, like, you know, in interacting with things like that, where like NPR or like the Times will like write an article about Asia, but like literally the only things that they're talking about are Eastern Asians, and you're like, that's not the entire experience, like,
yeah.
Yeah,
you're missing a whole subcontinent there. Yeah. I mean, but that, yeah, I think that what we're learning too, I feel like, and this is part of what's kind of exciting about the time we're living is, and I was talking about this with my mom, I just visited her. I was like, you know, I think people are really looking at language and ideas and shaking it and kicking the wheels and trying to see like, does this serve us anymore? Because I don't think a lot of things that how we talk about them just don't serve us anymore, you know? And it goes, that goes for, I think, identity, it goes for like ethno, you know, nationality and those type of identities. And I think that part of what's exciting about what you're doing with, you know, is like creating space that, so that we could talk about this and, you know, we could kind of, like change the direction in a way, like of the ship, you know, and start to be more inclusive and more cognizant of what we're talking about. If we're talking about a specific culture, so that we're not lumping them in, you know, or lumping ourselves in and washing over certain things that are very, you know, important about that culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like establishing Asian American culture.
Yeah.
Like, what, yeah. It's cool to be like living in this moment where like obviously there were so many Asian Americans before us, but like to be at this moment where
our generation is like fully taking charge over like what came before us and like what we're doing now to like be like, we're here, mm-hmm. so deal with it. Like, we right. deserve to as anybody else. Like, you know,
you brought us here, so now it's happening.
So sorry about that, but like, now we're here. There's actually, as like a side note, I'm reading this book called The Other 1%, which is all mm-hmm. about like Indian immigration to the United States. And it's essentially like trying to answer the question of like, why is this like the tiniest minority population in the United States, like immigrant minority population, also the most successful, like statistically, like the most socioeconomically successful. And so it really, it traces like the immigration and all of that. And it
that's interesting.
It's, I would totally recommend it, because there's like a whole bit about how like, you know, Indians in the 50s, 40s were like walking around trying to gain naturalization by being like, we're white because we're descended from the Aryans. And there right. were two Supreme Court cases about that. And it's like, what right. even yeah. is happening?
Yeah.
So there's a lot. Indian America is a long and complicated story. But
very, very messy story.
So messy. Like, none of us know it. Like, I mean, India, get your shit together, but also like Indians, get your shit together. Yeah. I would say. I really loved Closet Soups, and I think like I've never interacted with somebody who has, you know, written a story about a queer experience who themselves isn't queer. And I think that they're, you know, like that is an important lens into, you know, like we should also be talking about like, how do people outside of our communities like interact with us? And like, what is that lens into it like? And and I think that it's really powerful for me, just having a phone call with you, I was like, there are good Indian men out there. It's such a shitty thing to think, because like, yes, of course, but to interact with somebody who has really been like, yeah, like, you know, I want to uplift this community, and treating the identity as, you know, like similarly valid and meaningful as like any, you know, like an ethnic identity or anything like that was really awesome. And I do have to say, I like, when I was watching it, I like had to write down how much I loved when your Wolverine character fully just referred to somebody as, hey, bub, thanks for coming. I was like, the attention to I was like, these are some goddamn nerds that made a short film that really needed to make sure that the character continuity was there.
Yeah, I mean, the pains were taken, you know what I mean? Pains were taken.
This is canonically important, and at Marvel, like, where are you?
One of my actors literally like was trying to get like finish this shoot so he could get back to Comic-Con. So like, you know,
it's like that is my favorite thing in the entire
yeah.
world. Well, you guys, thank you so much for doing this. I had so much fun talking with you.
Yeah, same here.
And I'm like so excited about Closet Soups, and obviously I will be like yelling it out once, you know, like all of, you know, like the cool stuff when it's premiering and everything happens.
Thank you.
Because like it like really, really is such a great beginning to a conversation. And I think like in this moment in time where we're talking about Asian American identity, to have something that is, you know, like intersectional about Asian American identity and including that queer aspect to it is like really, really valuable and so important. And also like there's fully that scene in like your auntie and uncle's house where the auntie is just like making chapati. She's just like, this was me the other day when I was talking to my mom. I was just like mixing chapati flour together and talking to my mom.
Yeah.
It's very real.
To put it in. I mean, you know, it's like, I didn't dress her in a sari, but you know, like for me, the chapati was more important than the sari, yeah. You know?
I was like, yes. And then I was like, oh no, I have turned into an auntie. I was like, oh God. This was me 2 days ago. Not in a shalvar, but like just but okay, so again, thank you so much. I'm really, really excited about this. And before I let you guys go, which also might be because my dog is staring at me waiting for me to give her this porcupine. could both of you shout out a Bajan of the week? So that is any Asian, so you have billions of people to choose from, that is like inspiring you, you know, just like impacting you in literally any way. Yeah, who's your Bajan of the week?
Go ahead, Sam. I'll let you go first.
Okay, sure. I would say I forget like what his actual like ethnic identity is, but Brian Lee O'Malley, he wrote.
Yes. What? Yeah. I love you nerds so much. I love Scott Pilgrim so much. It is insane. Okay,
so, yes. So he wrote, like, as you were saying, like, you know, how, like, Kesa, like, kind of wrote this without being, like, queer himself. And I, you know, even if I have, like, a lot of female friends, like, since forever, I'm still a guy. Like, I still will never have the full understanding as much as it be to be a woman. But, like, his characters in a lot of his work from before and since Scott Pilgrim, like, so before he wrote, I think his first graphic novel was Lost at Sea, about kind of, like, a 17-year-old, like, little girl and, like, just kind of teenager, kind of, like, figuring things out for herself while kind of running away, in a sense. Again, a character I would not necessarily empathize with or understand, I guess. And he wrote, since Scott Pilgrim, this graphic novel, Precious, which is beautiful and gorgeous and fully in color. I highly recommend it. And then he currently has a series called Snot Girl. I don't know if you've read any of it.
Oh, I've seen it.
Yeah, it's, and the main character is a, like, kind of Instagram model type person who just through the nature of the series, like, also, like, her kind of queer identities kind of, there's exposure, like, she has to, but she's still dealing with, like, her ex-boyfriend and all these things. It was just kind of, like, a natural flow. There's nothing, like, shocking about it except for the own character kind of, like, dealing with all these things, and I think it's a good, really interesting and passionate exposure to those kind of ideas. And I was just kind of surprised that, oh yeah, this one guy can create all this output that's, I don't know, really female-centric and really female-strong, I would say.
It's really cool. Well, I mean, it's cool to see people from outside of the community do, you know, like, respectfully write these stories.
Right, exactly.
There is a lot of, you know, like, people also from marginalized communities should also be able to write their own stories as well. And I also think it's, like, so cool to see people from outside of the community so respectfully tackle those issues, because for me, when I'm interacting with it, like, interacting with Closet Soups, it's, like, there are people who are not queer South Asians that will respect me and will, you know, like, support and uphold me. And that feeling is, like, really, really powerful. So, like, you know, to have, like, a Brian Lee O'Malley or whatever, you know, like, talk about these different experiences, it's like, oh, like, cool, there's this person who, you know, like, I wouldn't think would be, like, you know, upholding me or my identity or whatever. It is. That's, like, such a cool form of solidarity, and very empowering in that way. Also, Scott Pilgrim is so good.
Right? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I really, really love Scott Pilgrim.
All right, so I'll put my Bajan.
Okay, so before you go. I heard the last podcast, and I know you're a big Star Wars fan and kind of looking for Asians in space.
Yes.
Have you ever seen that series Other Space?
Why does that sound...
It was made by Paul Feig. You can only, I think it's, like, viewable on, like, Yahoo. But if you Google it, actually, when I was, like, thinking about it and, like, thinking to bring it up, I Googled, I couldn't remember the name, so I think I Googled, like, Indians in Outer Space. And, like, it was, like, the second thing. But,
Indians in Outer Space.
But, yeah, it's called Other Space. It's a funny, funny series. It's, there's several Asians on it. I'm blanking on the names. I know Eugene Cordero was in it. I forget the name of the lead, but he was, he's more, I guess, famously known now as, like, the taxi driver in the Deadpool movies. I think.
Oh, yeah.
I forget his name, but yeah. But yeah, he's the lead, and I think you would like it. Yeah.
Oh my god. Okay. This looks hilarious. Yes, I will watch this. And for the record, I did find it by googling Indians in outer space.
Right.
So now my favorite search term for anything.
What is Asia? Indians in outer space.
Yeah, I really have a handle on like academic research. So if anybody wants to know how I wrote my senior thesis, it was like, what is?
So my Bayesian, I'm going to throw it up to Marie Kondo, tidying up with Marie Kondo, the Japanese woman who's like going and cleaning up cluttered for that. That phrase she gave us, does it bring you joy?
It's so good. I just texted one of my friends a meme of like Marie Kondo saying, does it spark joy with me?
Yeah.
This is me every time I look at my friends.
Yeah. Does it joy? Right. You know, like, you want to clean up your followers list? Like, this is like, does this follower spark joy?
You got to get those ratios correct on Instagram.
You got to get it correct. Very important.
It's so important. Okay, this was amazing. And I feel like we should just all hang out. I think let's all just hang out and watch Scott Pilgrim.
All right.
It's a good and movie. Talk about
this was a long way of saying let's hang out and watch Scott Pilgrim.
Honestly, I think that both of you should know that I use these podcasts as like an elaborate ruse to just make new friends because I don't know how to make adult friends. And I don't mean like adult, like sexy time friends. I just mean like friends who are also adults because like I don't have like soccer team. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like,
it's hard. It's hard after like, you know, intramural sports is like, or like whatever, like varsity sports is like, well, how do you do it?
I can definitely say, since I moved to Boston like 3 years ago and I didn't know kind of anyone except like, you know, maybe one or two like older friends who were really nice to kind of be supportive of me being here, I guess. But yeah, I kind of had to make like an entire new friend circle. And so I would go to like volunteering events of just things I wanted to go to, like, you know, just like different festivals and stuff. And the first like really good friend I made up here, like my shift was ending before like her shift. And she was like so funny and so nice. I was like, you know, I don't even know if I feel any romantic attention or anything. I just need to talk to this person again.
Yeah.
So I just very desperately said like, hey, so I just like, kind of moved here and I don't really have any friends, but I don't know, would you want to hang out or something? And she thankfully was like, yeah, of course. Like, what do you, why would you even question that? And like now she's one of my friends. So.
Oh my God, I love that. A success story.
Yeah.
There's hope.
It just takes like being that like blatant, I'd say.
I mean, like I did the very on brand thing for like a 20 something year old person to do. I joined improv. So like now all of my friends are like improv teammates, which is a nightmare and a blessing, and also like primarily a nightmare. But it's great.
I mean, like you don't want all like yes men or yes and men, I guess, like around you, but
no, we can't make any decisions because everybody says yes to everything. We don't know how to say no.
Right.
Feel oh, really. So is there anything? Do you guys have anything coming up that you want to promo, shout out, anywhere people can like gently stalk the work that you're doing?
Totally. I mean, you know, Closet Soups is like I said, is finishing it, so look out for that. You could follow me at K Wable, WABLE, that on Instagram, and you know, I'll post every development that happens there, and at BK Wable on Twitter. That's about cool. It. How about you, Thumb?
What about your music career?
Oh, sorry?
We didn't get to talk about your music, so.
Oh, yeah. It's a
drop
it's
your
a thing.
SoundCloud.
Yeah. I'm sure like an old MySpace is still up, like with some old songs or whatever, but no, I don't have things ready to, or that I would be, I guess, willing to like share anything, I'd say just like, if you're interested in me, go follow me at like at K Wobble on Instagram and Twitter. Like really cool stuff going on.
Amazing.
Best brother ever.
Well, thank you both for doing this. This was a ton of fun. And Kesav, you're going to be doing an Instagram takeover for us soon-ish, whenever.
Yeah. So I'm excited.
You'll get to see kind of into the world of Kesav. And also get to see more of...
It's going to be mostly my dog. It's basically going to be my dog.
I hope that it is just your dog and then like a tour of your Amartya Kathak like collection.
Yeah.
This is a vintage comic book of how Ganesha lost his head.
Yeah.
But yeah, thank you so much for doing this. I'm really excited to do more stuff with both of you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Maya. Thank you so much.
All right.
It was so nice to like actually meet you and talk to you about this stuff. You're doing amazing work, and this is just kind of thanks for allowing
thanks
me to
for creating the space. Really, it was really awesome.
You guys, I don't know how to deal with compliments, so I'm going to stop this recording right now.